Bonjour mes amis et bienvenue à la Crit Club. Cette semaine, nous regardons le film légendaire Les 400 coups. Or as it's butchered in English, The 400 Blows is what we watched here on Crit Club. My name is Peter Allen Clark, and I am your host for this week's episode. And I'm joined by three of the finest film lovers of North America. I'm joined by Corey.
What do you say at 4 o'clock? Bonjour, bonsoir.
Oh, bon.
It's still sunny out.
Bon après-midi.
Bon après-midi, yeah.
Bon après-midi.
Like that. Après-midi.
I'm also joined by Angelia.
Angel, oui, je suis ici. Et I'm going to take those 3 cigars out of your allowance.
Try and get them.
What a cool
and finally,
day.
And finally, oh. And that is, of course, the sultry voice of Wizard Chris. Hello to you,
bonjour,
good sir.
Bonjour, mes amis.
This week, as I said in my opening, we are going to be watching 1959 movie The 400 Blows, the 1959 movie 400 Blows by Francois Truffaut. It's not only his first film, it's also regarded as one of the signal flares that sparked the whole of the French New Wave, which was a bold new effort to reconsider filmmaking and shake up the visual languages of past decades. So The 400 Blows follows the adolescence and exploits of Antoine Tonnel through his abusive education, his self-obsessed parents, and a world that just won't let him get comfortable. It's a story that was a reflection of Truffaut's life, but it also echoes tales like A Catcher in the Rye, I thought of, that came out just a few years before. It's a story about the end of childhood. It's a story about chasing some sort of unknown mystery, and I kind of found it to be this real existential story in its active discomfort with the world around the main central character. While the plot is pretty straightforward and chronological, it slowly but surely creates nuance and room for understanding of this character to grow. So as a fan of the French New Wave movies that I've seen, and as a very, very humble student of film history, I chose this movie to try to help fill my gaps in this knowledge, and I'm really happy to share this experience with my friends here. I do have a lot to say about this movie, but I want to hear from the Crit Club first. And so, to you, my friends, I want to ask you, did the 400 blows sweep you off your feet like some kind of very unsafe-looking 1950s Gravitron? Or were you dying to sneak away while the other delinquents played soccer? I'm going to go with Corey first. Corey, how did you find Francois Truffaut's... Oh, I'm sorry. It is also Criterion Spine number 5.
Thank you.
Sank. Corey, how did you find Francois Truffaut's The 400 Blows?
You know, I would say if I was going to make my first movie, I wouldn't do it with a bunch of kids. Like, that was the first thing I thought of when I was watching this. I was like, my God, that's such a challenge.
A big swing.
You know, I have not watched a lot of French New Wave. I believe that probably the only French New Wave movies that I've watched, I probably watched with you all. And I think I've kind of stayed away from them for a while because I have this sort of preconceived notion about what they are. And I feel like, oh, they're just going to be pretentious and they're going to be boring and they're going to be whatever. And I'm glad to have watched this because I don't think this was particularly pretentious, and I certainly wasn't like bored by it. I think that one of the best things that about this movie that I really loved is you really get a sympathetic feel for the main character. I mean, like, they really make you feel and see how he's just, you know, pushed and pulled and, you know, living in this sort of antagonistic society and all that. And I really appreciate it. They really bring you along on the journey, you know, with this kid. And I can also totally see how this would be in a big, important film, you know, and this, you know, putting myself, obviously I can't go back to 1959 or whatever, but I can imagine just the sort of different ways of doing it and the sort of the longer shots, the sort of, you know, having that whole auteur thing where it's like you really, you know, get a feel of the director and all that stuff in there. You know, it all comes out in this. And I don't think this is like a movie that I probably would have watched on my own, and I don't think that I'm gonna keep watching French New Wave movies unless we pick them for here. But and I think probably my scoring is probably gonna reflect that, because like this isn't like a stereotypical Corey movie. But on the other hand, like there was a lot more going on in it than I think I thought it was gonna be. Like my conception of French New Wave, just as being an uneducated, you know, sort of goon on this, is going to be a bunch of people sitting around smoking cigarettes in cafes or whatever, and that's certainly not what this is. There's a lot of heart in this, and
it's just children smoking cigarettes.
Yeah, just children smoking.
Plenty
cigarettes.
Of smoking for the smoking fans. So, and
yeah,
the advocates
those are my
audience.
Sort of. Yeah, so those are my initial things. Like I'm not sort of jumping out of my feet for having seen this, but I can definitely see that this is a, you know, good and important film.
That's incredible. I'm so fascinated to hear that, and I can't wait to hear more of your thoughts, Angela. I'm going to turn to you next. How did you trouve
Truffaut?
What did you think of this? The Truffaut.
Man, I wish I had seen this before I had kids, because I would say, like, I mean, and I'm a parent of a child, much like the child in this movie, who has a lot of trouble in the classroom. And it was hard for me to, I mean, it's a great movie. I had a great time watching it. It was a good time. But the thing that really carried me through this movie was the compassion I had for this little kid who had so much upheaval and chaos and so little affection or understanding or trust. It made it so easy for me to go along with the story, because everything that he does, all the ways that he acts out, are because of the ways in which he's neglected. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. What's awesome about this film is that this is a personal story for the director. You know, this is him reflecting on his own childhood. And I just found it so interesting that you could set this story now and not have to change a whole lot. Because right now, I mean, none of you have children, but a lot of kids in the schools are acting out hugely. The teachers are having horrible problems because of all the pandemic. And it just really reinforces and reminds me of just, you know, how hard it is to be parents right now, that parents don't have the tools, that selfish people, especially when abortion isn't available to you, will, you know, just have babies and then they neglect them and it sucks. So what I loved the most was how that little kid was like, I'm just going to live, and I'm not going to live according to these rules, because however the rules were didn't apply to my life. So I particularly loved the ending. I won't ruin it. It's a little early to talk about the ending, but I enjoyed it. And that's all I have to say for right now.
Wow. Okay. Wizard, how did you, what did you think?
Wizard.
The 400 blows.
You know, I had kind of a lukewarm response to it, and I'm surprised, I guess. I'm sure if I had seen this movie as part of like the Le Grand Tour of cinema, like as a high school student or something like that, maybe I would have connected with it more. I should say it's really well done. I should preface everything by saying I really enjoy it. I was really moved by a lot of the imagery. I really, really enjoyed all the shots of Paris, and I just loved the way Truffaut shoots this movie. I had a hard time, I guess, connecting with the story, because I guess my big issue is that I really can see, like, you can really see it's like transparently like an auteur, like insert, like this boy character. And I guess my patience, or like my willingness to like fully engage with like an artist explaining, you know, their like tortured past or what have you, or like their like I was a misunderstood young man kind of story, like Catcher in the Rye, which is a book that we've mentioned already, and is a book that when I read in high school I also had a hard time connecting with, because I guess stories of like adolescent boys having trouble being adolescent boys, it's just not for, I mean, I had trouble being an adolescent boy too, but I just, these stories don't really connect with me in a meaningful way.
Fair.
And I'm not quite sure why that is, and maybe I'm kind of interested to see if I kind of, you know, uncover or awaken something while we go through this. But it's a beautiful movie. It's there are some scenes that are really, really well done. I really enjoyed like the scenes of the boys like smoking cigars and having a time. I really felt for the kid the whole time. Like, it really does, you know, it really does feel like you're chipping away at a childhood piece by piece. But, you know, despite all of that, despite the obvious, like, talent and everything involved, like, my response was kind of, eh.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and yeah, that's odd, I think.
Not odd. It's what you came away
that's
with.
That's what
it.
I came away with. What did you think, Peter? What did you think of the 400 blows?
I think I'm sort of similar on this. Like I've said, like, this isn't a movie that I would watch, but, like, I can appreciate it. I think we're on a similar page.
Yeah, I'd agree. I wasn't, like, the best film I've ever seen. I enjoyed watching it as a part of the new wave. I think that's cool, and it's sweet. And I see how it's impacted French films going forward.
I do. Angela. I do want to say that I understand. Yeah, I definitely understand how this is like a groundbreaking film, considering, like, you know, the concept of children as, like, people with, like, inner worlds and like conflict and challenges that are, like, meaningful, like, the idea of, like, presenting a story about a child with, like, a meaningful, like, existence, I think is something very new and novel for film during this time, and I really appreciate that aspect of the film.
I think this
film is
going to be one of those films where we actually like it a lot more after we've discussed it.
I expect so.
Well, it sounds like Peter liked it. What did you think?
In the grand Crit Club tradition of loving your own picks, yeah, it sounds like I liked it more than everyone here, I guess. Maybe, for the time being. And I think, but also for the reasons that everyone has already talked about. I think I came away with it already in the past. I guess it's been, you know, maybe 16 hours since I've seen it or so. Like, I've already thought about it a ton, and it's already, like, risen in my estimation. Mm. Like, this movie has stuck with me. The images, I think on its surface, the experience of watching it was kind of like, well, yeah, this is a little, it's got a hallmark of a lot of other Crit Club movies that we've watched, of just being like, this is his first movie. You see this, like, you know, this earnestness, but also maybe, like, a lack of specific production, you know, polish, mm. I guess, basically. But and so, you know, it was kind of like, but I definitely was engrossed into what's this kid, what's the story, like, following along. And I think it really, like, the word is kind of blossomed, which is a weird word to talk about my feelings with this movie, of as spending more time in this world, in this Paris, with this child, in this child's life, it just sort of, like, unfolded for me. I'm with you, Wizard, about, like, J.D. Salinger is one of my favorite authors of all time. Catcher in the Rye is my very least favorite of his books. Like, I also have a hard time connecting with, like, troubled boy, yeah, you know, sort of stories. But there's something about, like, I got lost in this kid's world, I think, because it felt so organically realized. Mm-hmm. And I think the way that it was organically realized for me, and maybe my biggest thing to say about this movie and my appreciation of it, is fucking Christ, the cinematography was incredible. Mm-hmm. Like, I think specifically talking about a 1959 movie, and we've watched, I was looking back through our list here of, like, the other movies we watched from the 50s. Like, this is just, you know, mind blowing to think about, like, the camera is so interested and curious. And there are these, like, scenes, like, I think about whenever he's, like, setting the table, and, like, instead of just, like, this one shot, like, the camera is following his movements, mm-hmm. like, panning a little bit as he goes over. Like, it really simulates this like, connection that you're feeling with this person by following through it. Like, there's just an energy, for lack of a better word, that the camera movement has throughout this film that really just made the whole thing spark and really grow alive with me. Mm-hmm. I really just can't say enough about just how, like, full of life this movie felt in that way. Mm-hmm. But I also think that it captured child, like, it did, like, I, as I said in my intro, like, the end of childhood, but it still also had a bunch of childhood in it, like, in this really specific and, I think, like, kind of brilliant way. Like, the scene of the kids at the puppet show.
Oh, that was very cool.
Faces of these kids, mm-hmm. like, so, like I think about, like, the fair and the Gravitron, the kids at the puppet show, like, this kid's hard life was not without like these flashes of actual childhood joy, you know, and like the wrapping it around that, like this felt like a real textured three-dimensional view of sort of like an end of childhood experience and coming to that. I also thought the music was fantastic. At the same time, like the kid wasn't a great actor. Kids aren't great actors, and I didn't think the kid was like, you know, it wasn't an ingenue in that point. I don't know, but it's just a movie that I already thought about a lot, and I think I will like seriously like 3 hours ago I was like, do I have time to kind of like start it over and like watch it again, because I just kind of can't get this movie out of my head. Mm-hmm.
Can't believe you guys thought the kid was a bad actor. There were too many layers. He's a kid. Yeah. It's all in French. There's too many layers for me to judge a performance, you know?
I'm pretty unforgiving, and I think that's a fault that I'll gladly own. Fair, I'm pretty unforgiving about bad child
actors. Sure, yeah.
And he wasn't bad. He wasn't bad at all. There was just like a point or two. But then you have these moments. Like, and I'm curious to talk about a little bit of like the structure of the movie too, because like there's that interview scene at the end, which was like, oh man, because I mean incredible acting from this kid, and also like odd, like I don't know if I thought it was good or bad of like placing that context for this kid's life so late in this story, you know.
Well, yeah, but that scene's also like the most that he's really talked.
Yeah,
like, it's the most, I mean, because he doesn't have a lot of conversations.
People don't ask him questions.
Short and to the point, and stuff. Yeah, they're all talking above him and over him and through him and all that.
Yeah, I want to sum it up so we can talk. Like, my thoughts on it are really about how well I think this movie encapsulates childhood, both the ending of it as well as the joys of it. I think going back to what I said at the intro, the existentialism, like this kid cannot get comfortable. Like, I think about him sleeping at his parents. I think of him trying to sleep in that factory, him trying to sleep at his friend's home. Like, there is like a real like discontentment that is shaped throughout this, and I think the cinematography and the camera work bring that to bear in such a unique and like incredible way that to me is timeless rather than just being significant for the 1959 movie. And that's my thoughts.
Well, and I think that last point is really kind of really important here. Like, so I think Super Mario Brothers 2 is one of the greatest video games that's ever been made. And is it actually one of the greatest video games ever made? Like, probably no, not by a long shot, but the fact that I played it when it came out in 1988 and it was mind-blowing to me at the time.
It's a good game. Like, it's very good.
It's a great game. I still play it almost every year. But is it actually like going to still hold up to like modern video games and all that stuff? It's like, well, I mean, probably not as much as like, you know, what we can do sort of with films now and stuff. And so I think really like accepting this film as a part of a movement, as something that really changed how we made movies and all that stuff. And just the fact that there weren't things being made like this necessarily in the 1950s. Like, I think that's an importance that, like, you know, unfortunately just kind of gets lost when you're watching everything in the here and now, I guess.
Well, I mean, to start with, of like where this movie came from, and just as being the start of the sort of French New Wave, or one of the starts of the French New Wave, I think Agnès Varda does take that with a movie that wasn't even able to be seen until 2008. But did you all follow or read up enough on Truffaut and this whole thing to see that he wrote basically a manifesto of what became sort of?
Yeah, I saw like, the wrote a manifesto dealing, and I was like thinking of Dogma 95.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. I've got the manifesto right in front of me. I was like trying to read through it.
My rules for
but
movies.
Yeah, this is another Dogma 95. Oh, I like
the
love
original
that.
Dogma 95.
Does it have a certificate though? That. Is the important question.
That's true.
No, but no, the beginning of the film does honor André Bazin, who is the author of the Cahiers du Cinéma, which is a huge French review of cinema. So that kind of sat in my head watching this movie was, you know, this is all about what is good cinematography and good editing. Mm.
What are some of the takeaways from the manifesto, Peter?
I love he's got a section here at the top that just says, it's a heading that says, "What annoys me, ...
I'm on board already.
Awesome.
I know. But it's like, it's what I said, and I think it's fascinating because I also think it's the same spirit of the Dogma 95 of like a younger generation feeling like the older generation who is in charge of productions of like cinematic art feeling too staid and creaky in these old forms and these old expectations and these production styles. And I don't know, you just see that throughout the 400 Blows. Anyway, I would like to sort of, we don't have to go beat by beat, but I would like to take sort of this movie in chunks and to sort of poll about what you all are thinking about it. Let's start with the school. Like, this depiction of this insane teacher, like,
Sourpuss.
This, you know, this Sourpuss teacher, like, this, like, sort of public humiliation, like, I these fascinating sort of scenes. There was a point when I wrote in my notes that this is this the inspiration for Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
Could be, actually.
But how did you all find your place within Antoine Brudel's world within school? I think it's interesting that it starts at school.
So one thing that rings true for me, one thing that I can relate to that I really like constantly kept fixating on during the school scenes, the film generally, but the school scenes in particular, as a child, it is absolutely devastating to discover that an adult doesn't like you. Especially one that you see every single day, like a teacher or like, you know, like an adult that you see every day doesn't like you. You're like 11 or 12 and you're like, I have no idea why. Like, this person's an adult. And this relationship, the relationship between between Antoine and his teacher is just, it reminds me of relationships that I've had with teachers in the past. And it's that thing of like, oh, my God, it's so terrible to see like adults like actively dislike children so much that it like disrupts their ability to succeed in anything. And those school scenes were so hard for that reason, you know?
And with this being at the beginning of the movie, you know, when I'm still trying to pick up on like the tone and all that stuff of the movie, like, I'm just like, is this like a comedy? Like, is this, 'cause it seems so exaggerated, but it also at the same point wasn't seeming funny, but it like, I guess just, it just made me feel good about sort of at least coming of age in the time and place that I did, because man, yeah, this is just cruel. It's just, and I guess that's what it's doing. It's setting up is like the this world that this kid is being raised in is a cruel sort of inhumane world where you can just get smacked upside your head for, you know, misbehaving and stuff. Like,
I felt the same thing about a comedy. Like, there was some weird, like, a Christmas Story vibes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Oh.
Very much,
oh, that's funny because, yeah, my friend was like, oh, this is just the beginning, the origin story of Christmas Story.
Yeah, my wacky dad and my crummy school life and all that stuff.
I think it is notable, and I think it's very interesting that it does start within school, because I think institutions overshadow this entire story and this entire boy's life. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's not like his relationships with his parents and his life. It's like the institution that forms the sort of patterns and routines that like that set this boy's motion, like the world around him. Like, what are the rules that are being set in front of him and how does he function within them?
Yeah.
And there was like this one part where it's like behind, it's like fascinating. There's this one scene where he's like behind the board. I guess you go stand in the corner, which is also
in the corner.
Wild. Yeah. Like, to me, that's like worse than a dunce cap of like, you hide behind this panel. Yeah. That's you in trouble. But like this, like, it was almost like a stage play where he's cleaning off the writing on there and the kids in the desks are doing these other things while the teacher is teaching.
Well, and the one kid just keeps getting ink all over everything and like wiping his hands.
Weird.
I thought he was going to be the main character at first, I guess, because they would spend so much time on him wiping his hands.
Well, that's like that's what is interesting. I was like trying to note, because it does seem like there are weird little shots that follow random children within these classes. Like, you know, that kid or one of the kids, you just see him walking down the street later on in the film for one shot. Like, it is like it's very interested in just, I guess, childhood, boyhood, I guess, specifically. But finds its own sort of like meandering way to showcase it.
Yeah. And I think like too, just modern Americans have such a romantic view of Paris and, you know, of France and of Paris especially and stuff. And like, this Paris is grungy and dirty and gross. And like, even the sort of driving down the street at the beginning, like alt panning, like, if you're like driving down a boulevard in France, you'd expect to see some like beautiful, gorgeous buildings, but they all just look terrible. It looks like this, you know, falling apart industrial place that's, you know, still getting over being, you know, war torn and all that. And so,
oh, I forgot about that part. I thought we were like coming real hard at Paris, and then I was like, no, I guess it's post-war Paris.
It struck me when he goes home and is going through those things of just like what a well-behaved child mm-hmm. he is, like in so many ways. I don't know, and I didn't think about it until you mentioned it, Wizard, of like, oh, this is you know, an author's boy's life or whatever, and maybe it's he just right. saw himself as this, oh, he's just a good kid, and they were just always terrible and mean to me. But it did yeah. strike me of just how like considerate and uncomplaining he was, because I think I would have been a complaining yeah, child in those circumstances.
Yeah, he takes that stinky trash downstairs and puts it in the ground. I mean, he does his chores and all that, and it seems like
living this latchkey kid lifestyle.
It's really this other friend of his that's the bad influence.
And it shows. I'll stop talking so much about the cinematography, but there was so much about this movie that was just fascinating to me, of like him taking down the trash. It shows like all four floors of that walk mm-hmm. up. Like it shows him mm-hmm. going all four floors. Like, and I feel like in most movies there would be a point to spending that time on the screen, but here the point is that this boy does this, mm-hmm. you know. And I really found that like. I guess this is, I don't know. So listeners being kind to me of like how far this like overlaps with like a verite style or something. But there seems something to be, there just seems like an honesty about this movie. Or an attempt at honesty mm-hmm. of like going down the stairs.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's an honesty, but there's also like the prolonged time gives him an association with being the trash as well.
Oh, that's a really interesting point.
Aww. And that this kid, I mean, his room is barely a room. It's like the living room. It's like the entrance.
It's wild. Yeah. And it's fucking a foyer.
They step over him when yeah. they come in.
Oh, man, I'm just heartbroken over this kid. But he became a famous film director. So maybe there's something to be said for suffering as a child in some way to be able to tell stories. Ugh.
But yeah, no, man, so I think him standing in the foyer and all that is also just kind of showing how he is just in the way in this household. Like, yeah. it's unloving, mm. uncaring parents and stuff, and he's just in the
that's
way.
That's a really good way of saying it, in the way. That's mm-hmm. so true. That's so correct. And, like, yeah, the transitions always, were a little weird. Like, I didn't pinpoint the exact moment when, like, the next day or whatever, it's like, let's skip school. Like, I didn't.
Yeah.
kind of follow that whole thing, but I did think that was like seemed like a notable turning point of this being like maybe his first taste at freedom and feeling like freedom, this is what freedom is, and freedom can just be like a literal carnival if this is what it is. And it's, you know, it's pretty great watching them run around a post-war Paris.
I mean, that is the taste of freedom, but that's sort of the event that sort of then causes this cascade yeah. of stuff that he is ultimately not able to escape out of until he escapes the detention place, I guess.
Y'all ever been on a Gravitron?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
No.
Upstate New York. Elizabethtown.
I get motion sick.
I used to get... I just watched that and I'm just like, man, I would just get such a wanging headache now. Like... Yeah, I was one of those kids who was spinning upside down and all that stuff. I remember one time I was at the Indiana State Fair, the Kentucky State Fair, and I lost my wallet on the Gravitron. And so aww. I had to, like, talk to the carny, and he, like, showed me the inner workings of the Gravitron. And, like, he went and, like, took the panels off, and I got to see, like, the insides of it, and we found my wallet.
Oh, wow.
Hey.
If you would have asked me if Gravitrons existed in 1959, yeah. I would have said no.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was.
Like,
yeah.
Today I learned.
Yeah, I was.
Does not seem safe.
Yeah, I was scared for the actors on that thing.
Like, honestly, there was this, like the woman to, I guess, the right of of Donnell. I was just like, she seemed like a well-manicured woman wearing something that probably shouldn't be leaning against a Gravitron wall.
Yeah, it's like she just got off work at her, you know, secretarial job and decided, well, before I, you know, go buy my baguette for the evening, I'll just jump on the old Gravitron for a few minutes to
it's
unwind.
It's important to remember that people used to dress up to do literally everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. For sure.
Yeah, yeah, I guess so. So, yeah, what happens next? We don't have to go beat by beat.
I mean, this really is what kicks it off, like the whole mix up with the sick note and all that stuff. And
him saying his mom died.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I loved that. That was funny. Yeah. A good parent would have laughed, would have been like, well, no, they would have been a little upset. But still, like, you got to see the humor in, of it. I mean, but these are selfish people. Yeah. Certainly. Was so sad when he became interested in literature, like Henri de Balzac, mm-hmm. and like created a shrine, mm-hmm. which is something like Patti Smith used to do, right? And he lights this candle and inadvertently starts a fire. I mean, these are all normal things that kids do, and that good parents see the or ask or try to find out, like, what was the impetus? What were you trying to do mm-hmm. here?
And you don't just walk into school and smack him in front of the whole class.
Yeah.
Yeah. Loved the Balzac bit.
Yeah.
Loved it. Like a real man. Wizard, you ruined my thoughts about this movie because now I'm just thinking about Truffaut's like. I was really into Balzac. Like,
there is some, and it just, you know, that's the thing that got in the way of the movie mm-hmm. for me, is this kind of like self-aggrandizement of being a difficult future brooding young man, a young Werther kind of vibe, you know.
Well, but let me ask you this, though. I mean, because, like, you know, because these crimes escalate, you know, like the lies and then like stealing the things. But I still never felt like I got a sense that, like, that the movie was telling me that this is just a thief with a heart of gold or some sort. Felt like it did seem like a realistic person to me. It didn't feel like an overly romanticized, you know, like child who's just crazily misunderstood. It just felt like, a real person who's not giving any sort of chance to understand how to act in the world.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head when we talk about the movie being about institutions and kind of how they're suffocating to youth and to all of the nice things that youth represents, you know?
Well, let me bring up this. Did anyone else think of this? Because I, like, immediately was clocking this. Another Crit Club moment.
Here comes.
Pishoach. Did anyone else think of Pishoach?
Mm-hmm. I did think about
this. This is proto-Pishoach. Like, 1,000%. Yeah. This is proto-Pishoach.
Yeah, but this...
I did think of another Crit Club pick.
Oh, which one?
Ooh. Oh, I did,
I'm
too.
I'm sure we can guess. I was waiting for Peter to bring it up.
Can I tell you? I didn't think about it until we started recording, and I wrote down Vagabond.
There we go. This is the adolescent male Vagabond. This is where it starts.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
But I did think more like aligned with Pishoach of just like institutional and just like the ways in which
That's true. And it's funny that I didn't even think of it until now. I think that I feel like the tones of these two movies are so different. Yeah. I mean, the subject matter is definitely very similar, but this one is like, this one's, you know, bittersweet. It's sort of long of a time past, but it doesn't feel like nostalgic. You know, it's not like, like you said, the Christmas Story. Like, there's not like a nostalgic glean on it or anything like that. But Pishoach is just dire. Like, it's
rough,
just
very dire. Different time, different place.
Well, it's one of those things where, you know, and I don't want to say I know more than I do, but like, it felt like the characters in Pishoach were maybe like 2 years older than Danelle, you know? And like, this is like the proto Pishoach of like, this is the snowballing. This is the start of the lead, you know, if this were another system, another whatever. But I feel like when we talk about institutions and we talk about sort of the rules that the world in which these children are born and raised, like, I think there's a lot of similarity. I agree with you completely about tone, but I did think a ton about Pishoach watching this movie. But also Vagabond. Fuck yeah, man. This kid. Yeah, thank you. Sorry, I'm gonna say the exact same things I've said in multiple episodes, but like, a force of nature, like, this kid is less of a force of nature than my dear Vagabond, but still there is that like wildness and that like incompatibility, I think is lost, like the word, and you know, what I said at the beginning of like this discomfort with the world, like this incompatibility of like not even like rebelliousness, but just like ignorance for like, you know, how to maintain and what to sort of do, like,
you're just like a peg that stands out. There's like the kid is not like especially in the beginning of the movie, he's not like especially like defiant or rebellious or dysfunctional. Like it starts with him, like, you know, the movie really sets itself up with this opening scene where he is just unlucky. He just gets like picked out because all the other, like, they're passing around that magazine, right, or calendar or whatever. And he just happens to be holding the bag when the teacher turns around. And that's like one of those like unfortunate things that happens, you know, the character has responsibility and agency and all that kind of stuff, but there are repeated instances of like kids just being unlucky and people assuming the worst because that's where they're at with him,
Well,
and that
he
really
like
sucks,
catches his mom. Sorry,
you feel that?
he like catches his mom cheating,
Yeah.
and like you'd think that in a sort of a different kind of movie, like that would be his leverage, and now he can start, you know, fighting back. And he doesn't fight back. Like, it's not used as leverage. Like, if anything, she uses it as leverage for him, at him or whatever and stuff. And so it kind of just shows that, yeah, he's not a malicious person, you know. He's not,
Well,
even when
but
he's
I think
like
he's a
handed it on
child.
a silver platter, like, here's something you can use to fight back against these systems that are oppressing you, he doesn't do it, you know.
Well, no,
But
it's
I
because
took
he's a
that.
kid, and a kid shouldn't be using those things against his parent. The parent is the parent here, and the parent
Right.
should have been like, hey, I know you saw that. I'm really sorry you saw that. I mean, because they don't go more into detail, I feel like that scene is really just about how destabilized this family unit is and how unstable this child is, and that he has absolutely nothing to go on or any motivation to follow these institutions, the institution of the family, the institution of school. There's no reason, especially since luck seems to keep dealing him a rough hand. And getting caught and stuff like that. So.
Yeah, I agree. Like, there's like no, I don't know if a child like this would think of like leverage or how to use that, and just have the confusion of what even that means or what, you know, like. And I think he talks about it in the letter that whenever he first runs away is we'll discuss all that happens. And I don't know, it's just like him, yeah, just being a kid. I don't know. This is the sort of like emotional imbalance of like on the precipice of puberty or like on the precipice of like adolescence that this movie shows. I found to be just like very honest and really strikingly true in a lot of ways that are exactly that of like confusion rather than knowing exactly what something means. So then he runs away, sleeps in a plant,
For us, the
steals
first
a
time.
typewriter.
Do
Well, yeah, no, I
did
mean,
we skip?
Oh yeah, what do
it
you all
comes back
talk
at
about? No,
some
what do you want
point.
to talk about?
Did we
Yeah, it
skip
comes
the
back.
wine and cigar party?
I loved the wine and cigar party.
That's when he runs away the second time.
Is that the
Yeah,
second time? Okay, that's right.
So yeah, the family seems like it's gonna be okay after he almost burns down Balzac.
Hey, this bottle of wine's empty. Hey, I've been there, kid.
And then what is the thing that like incites him to leave
Well,
school?
I just want to say, like, when we're talking about like the wine and cigar party, like it's interesting to see that this character, I don't remember his name, the kid, that is the one who's like inciting him to do all these bad things. Or he's the one that's pulling him to like play
Remy.
hooky and all that stuff.
Remy.
Remy, yeah,
Yeah.
right.
No, that's not him, right? Or yeah,
Yeah, that's
no.
Remy. Or
Renee.
Renee.
Renee, sorry,
Yeah. But you can see how like the consequences for Renee are different than the consequences for what's the main Antoine. Where, you know,
Antoine.
Antoine is, you know, obviously very, very low income. And his, you know, Renee's family is very like they have this big house and you know all that
Stuffed
stuff.
horse, the
Yeah.
taxidermied
The stuffed
horse.
horse, Bucephalus, the stuffed horse.
So like he's able to just get away with this
Not a
stuff.
coat
And he's
rack.
like, he doesn't have these consequences. And even if he does get in trouble at school, it's like, well, his dad will take care of it or whatever. But like, yeah,
Yeah.
Antoine does not have that level of support.
Yeah.
It showcases like different kinds of neglect to a certain extent. Like this, like Renee's father is also neglectful. What is it? They're like he and his son are eating dinner, and he's like, your mom like tries to be out of the house so that we don't have to eat together or something like that. She's avoiding me or something like that. Like
They're
unhappy families in unhappy situations, but like everyone's like unhappiness is different, the thing.
I guess, I guess I was just trying to say, like, they're both coming from houses of nearly equal neglect, but only one of their lives is falling apart.
Only one person really experiences like consequences and like really experiences, like the classic like delinquency funnel to like menial labor or the army kind of track.
Man, but I think about it. I kept thinking about sleep and comfort with this, and I guess that's what I've said a few times. And I think about like Donnell, like having to sleep in the sleeping bag because his dad didn't buy him sheets for whatever, like the foyer sleeping bag. Can't sleep in the plant because like strange men show up on there. Like having to like sleep under like secretly in his friend's room, like when he's arrested, like sleeping sitting up in the cage there. Like I keep thinking about like comfort and finding any place to rest.
And then there's the one time that his mom is nice to him where
Oh,
he gets
yes.
to like sleep
Lay
nude
on the
in the in
bed.
their bed,
Yeah, forgot about
and
that.
he like experiences like all of the comfort that has been lacking up until and it's all artificial because she's like just trying to like win him over, as she puts it, I think. But he gets like the comfy bed, and he gets like an adult who asks him questions and confides in him, and again, like respects like his interiority as like a human. And like so much of the movie is like children have interior lives, they have hopes and dreams, and they are underserved by neglectful institutions. It's, I guess I do feel bad for Truffaut now. I didn't at first. I was like, whatever, man. But
I mean, I agree with you guys about I'm not a fan of Catcher in the Rye, but
me neither. It's not.
Yeah,
I know it's
It's a
Corey's
great
favorite.
book.
It's Corey's favorite book.
It's
I
not my
always
favorite
I don't think it's
book.
a bad book.
It's not my favorite.
I don't
It's a
think it's a
great
bad
book,
book,
You told
though.
me at some point that it was your favorite book, but that's
Franny
okay.
and Zoe,
Oh
all the
yeah,
way.
I love
A
all of
thousand
Salinger's
percent.
other stuff too, but Catcher in the Rye is also great.
It's a good book.
But I felt like, to me, this wasn't a Catcher in the Rye story because it sort of felt like the character in Catcher in the Rye was just kind of being contrary for the sake of being contrary, whereas this kid seems like genuinely harmed. And it's been interesting to me to watch how the parents talk about the kid, when they're talking to the police officer, the mom is talking about him. And I know parents like that. Like, who really don't have any self-reflection to understand, just expecting their kids to behave a certain way and not seeing that if you want your kid to change, the kid isn't going to change unless you change. You're the one who actually, the parent has to be the one to change the environment for that kid for them to thrive. And so it just seemed so realistic to me.
Yeah, it did. It did. And so where do you think this, how do you all think about where this movie goes of stealing the typewriter, failing to pawn it, trying to put it back, getting arrested, going to juvie?
This
It's like
isn't
the
a
downward
story.
yeah.
It's a downward spiral. This isn't a joyful, like I am flaunting society. This is a lost child. It
Yeah,
sucks.
like an impulsive child, like you do impulsive shit. Like you steal a typewriter and then you try to take it back and
Oh God, that breaks my heart. That felt
you're
like, because again, that felt like him not like doing the good thing. It was just like, this seems like what I should do now. This seemed, I don't know. Like it was, I
Yeah, I
don't
mean, he's
know.
doing what he's got to do to eat and stuff. And like, if he didn't get caught on this sort of, bumble, he was going to get caught on the next one. Like, he's just sort of bumbling his way through, being a street kid, and yeah, of course they're gonna catch him.
Man, yeah.
And then just yeah, the responses from the parents and father just disowning him. I mean, I know it's not biological, but still, it's just all just, yeah,
It's all
tragic,
tough.
The mom,
really.
the mom asking whether the juvie center is going to be near the beach or near the sea or something.
Well, okay, so this was my one little nitpick.
Go for it.
Because we're getting close to talking about the end or whatever. So, like, you have this big ending thing where he just, like, runs and runs and runs and runs to the beach or whatever. I feel like the wanting to see the ocean stuff, it just felt a little tacked on. It felt a little what is the want of the protagonist that we're supposed to identify with that carries us through the narrative? And that part of it
I just felt a little tacked Let's talk. Let's talk. I've got my theories about it.
I adore the ocean theme. It is the opposite of all of the structures that...
Sure.
And so I was like, this makes so much sense. I mean, he had never seen the ocean. Can you imagine never seeing the ocean?
Mm. I identify with it. I see why it's in there. It felt the most sort of like, it didn't feel woven in. It just felt like it was like, had to be like mentioned a couple times so that we could have this payoff at the end. And it felt tacked on.
Sure. I thought there's like a bittersweet aspect to it. Like, you want to see the ocean, that's cool. But here, like the ocean is like a wall that you've run into, you know, like you can't.
That was exactly my thought. Okay. Like, it wasn't so much.
There's nowhere left to go. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Like, it wasn't like a romanticism around it. Like, it wasn't like, I didn't pick up on that. Cause I agree with you, Corey. That was like, I didn't know that was the character's desire or want, but as soon as he runs up to it and can't go any further, I immediately thought the same thing as Wizard. Like, this is a boundary. Like, this is absolutely a wall. Like, all he's trying to do is escape this world he's in, and he's hitting yet another boundary that he can't escape. Like, that was precisely my thought around it. Exactly that
he is trapped in this life.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, I complain like, oh, I'm honestly getting emotional talking about it. Like, I like this movie has like grown within me, but like
it's existential in that way. Yeah. It ends on an existential note where like you can't, he fundamentally can't run away, right? He is going to have to confront all of these things of reality, of having to provide for himself. And interestingly, this is the fourth in like, the first in 4 to 5 films.
Yeah, let's watch all of them. Let's watch Donnell grow up.
I thought that was so fascinating. That kind of, I found that out before I finished this movie. And I find that so fascinating that Truffaut chooses to come back to this character, this like self-insert, this DMPC for the folks tracking D&D references.
We are Crit Club,
yeah. That's right.
I find it so fascinating that he chooses to pull like a Richard Linklater and like keep coming back to this fictional version of himself periodically. I would love to see a few more of these movies just to see to follow this boy, so to speak. Don't isolate that.
But it is. But I agree with you, because to me this feels like a self-contained story. Like, well, I'm literally contained by the ocean. Boy, man, I am even more fucking Jesus. I'm more hit than ever by that. That ending really. I was like, oh, cool, huh? But now I'm like wanting to fucking cry.
Definitely coming around. I'm like, oh, wait, that lukewarm feeling is starting to bubble and simmer. It's nice.
What else haven't we talked about here? Was there anything we haven't talked? The score, anybody else on the music? I really thought the music was like, I am normally kind of unimpressed by the vast majority of music scores or film scores, but I was like, this is cool and interesting and moving.
I mean, all I remember is like the sort of guitar arpeggio stuff. I don't know if I noticed it very much.
I liked it because it wasn't intrusive. It was a companion, but not. It didn't get in the way of what I was witnessing in the film.
I thought it had like character. Yeah. I don't know. Anything else that we haven't talked about that we haven't discussed?
This is going way back to the very beginning, but it was. I'm realizing now how. So in like script writing, there's this idea of like stating your theme, and it's usually some character states what the movie is about, or it's what the movie is like not about, you know, or something like that, where it's like this sentence at the beginning. And I'm realizing that the essay that Sourpuss gave them to write. It's like, what is your duty to your, you know, your family and your government and the, you know, the church, and you're like, that's the essay they have to write and stuff. It's like, oh, that's the essay of, or that's the theme of this movie right there.
But and also the thing that they're also working on to memorize is the hair.
Is
like the rabbit running, running.
True.
And then of course the dad does say that he thinks a storm is coming. So in case you need any other screenwriting tips, always mention a storm is coming.
they're all there.
I also thought there was a little bit of Rushmore in this movie.
Yeah, there's a little bit of, but see, Rushmore is a, and this is the confusing part. Rushmore is a movie about an adolescent that I do connect with and like does land for me emotionally, and that's probably just the Wes Anderson of it all.
It's also a lot funnier.
But yeah, I definitely.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure.
It's a lot funnier. It is a lot funnier. That's true. yeah, it's funny and clever and all that jazz. Whereas this is a very like sort of very grounded, like real film.
I'm looking through my notes and I'm just the fucking rich kids or whatever middle class kids house and like those fucking cats.
Oh my god.
Like everything about that was like pretty great. Those fucking cats, the stuffed horse, the kid saying, "I'll take an advance on my inheritance."
Yeah, right.
And then that's what you said, Angela, about like deducting 3 cigars from your allowance.
Yeah.
Man, but the faces of those kids.
Just like the idea of them like the kids like, shit, my dad's home. Let's air out this room in the next like 25 seconds after smoking cigars. It's like a, it reminds me, there's a similar scene, a Linklater connection again in Dazed and Confused, where they're smoking weed in a kid's bedroom and they're like, oh shit, my parents. And they do the exact same thing. They just kind of like wave the smoke around. They're like, bam, done. I'm like, guys, that never works. Your parents know. But in France, they don't care. And that's the beauty of it all.
And the kid, oh yeah. All right. I have one more topic of, if people don't mind, specifically, it is Paris. It is like, you know, I think if I can say it without making a joke out of it, Paris is a character in this movie.
You can't.
You know, it, like I feel like that there's, and maybe it's more so broadly of like the world around Donnell, but I do feel like there are explorations across this city that are very notable, and I think specifically there's definitely a juxtaposition between the very opening. Sort of sweeping shots of going through, you know, and seeing the Tour Eiffel, and like counterparting that with whenever Donnell is like being taken away by like the police coach looking at the streets of Paris behind the bars, you know, of that.
But that's like one of the only times when the city looks nice and pleasant and
oh
cool.
I don't know, I mean like him and Renee go running around true. I think it looks that's like Sacré-Cœur. Yeah. Like there's the carnival at the first part, and then I think it's like Sacré-Cœur, like
when he's at home it all seems very grungy and cramped and gross, but then when he's actually out doing things and
yeah
that's when it opens up.
You
had alluded to it, I'm not going to try to pronounce it, but the title of this movie is a French idiom, which means like to raise hell. Which does not translate in the United States or into like, you know, English.
Well, it would actually translate to hellraiser, which is what we call kids who don't conform. He's a little hellraiser. Well,
Les quatre sans coup.
Yeah, like the whole phrase is faire la compte sans coup or whatever. And so it's a phrase that means to raise hell. And so I guess they had tried rebranding it as Wild Oats originally.
Which is the worst title.
It's bad, yeah.
Not good. Bad title.
What so they called it? Wild Oats.
I mean, Foreigner Blows is a cool title. It's definitely evocative. Even if it doesn't translate into English.
You know, I'm sure at one point in my youth, I assumed that The 400 Blows was a French, like, martial arts film. Anybody else?
Yeah, or I thought there was going to be a lot more violence in this or something, but I thought there were going to actually be, you know, a lot of him getting hit or corporal punishment or whatever, but yeah, that's
they're just, existential it's just, blows. It's just a phrase. They're spirit blows.
Yeah, existential blows. There you go.
Man, anything else we could talk about? And anyone else, or should we roll?
I think it's time.
Boy, y'all, I really appreciate you talking about this movie with me. Shit. Okay, what do we do here on Crit Club is we do something a little different. Paris is a character in our podcast. We, instead of any sort of traditional rating systems, we do our own in honor of the D20. We rate on a 1 to 20 scale, 1 being a fail and 20 being a crit. And that's how we do things here. I'm going to go in the same order that we started off with. Corey, to you first. What are you thinking about the 400 blows and how would you roll on it?
I'm actually going to go back to one other thing I forgot to mention. I learned a little something about this. You know, all the denominations of the franc in this were like had me like 1,000 francs, 500, like what? And it's and so, but yeah, apparently in 1959, there was I forget what the technical word for it was, but basically 100 francs became 1 franc again, whatever, in 1959. So like that was, and so that got me wondering, it's like, when does this take place? This, I guess this is, it's not 1959, I guess, right? Like, are we closer to the just post-war stuff? I don't know.
Oh, I honestly don't know.
I don't know. That's a good question. No. It does.
Yeah, it never said.
Yeah.
Did they have gravitrons even before? That's 1959? True.
Yeah. I think this is a 1940s was developed gravitron? As a Nazi super weapon.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Anyway, those were just a couple other thoughts that I had. I liked this movie. And I like it more having talked to you all. So I think I was originally coming into this around a 12, but I'm going to give it a 14.
Awesome. Yeah, man. Angela, how are you feeling about 400 blows?
You know, it's hard because, I mean, I didn't love it, but I didn't hate it. It was just kind of okay, but I get how important it is. And I also appreciate this. It's not often you get to see depictions of these parents and children in the context of a city. And France actually is really great at that. You know, there's also Le Boom. If anyone has ever seen that movie, it's a classic 1970s adolescent film. I will give it a 17.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really just based on my esteem for it in the cinematic pantheon, not so much how much I enjoyed watching it. If I say how much I enjoy it, I would give it a 14, but it gets a 17. And then just...
You can give it a 14.
I don't want to. No, it's a classic.
No one's judging you.
I afford
no one's guarding
it the respect it deserves. But I will also say that for the D&D people on our show, that you guys decide is Antoine a fighter, a young fighter with a horrible backstory, or a potential rogue? A very bad rogue who isn't good at stealing things. But
we have to learn, you know, like
we all have to start somewhere. But you know, trying to return your stolen typewriter is maybe a critical fail in terms of
reverse pickpocket, one of the great tricks of thievery.
I'm gonna say maybe he's a monk, like after finding out how to trying to square his own life with the world around him and the environment, and trying to center his focus.
Takes a lot of ki.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wizard, how many ki points are you giving this?
I'm going to give this, I think I'm going to give it a 16.
Whoa.
Which is actually higher than okay. Well, it's higher than I expected. And, you know, as always, like talking about it helps. And like, you know, I find like as we talk about it, I like remember very distinctly like the visuals and like the images of the film. They kind of like are like playing in my head as we talk about the movie. And like, I think that's even if I didn't like connect with it on like an emotional level, it's, you know, in a lot of ways, it's like a beautiful knickknack on my shelf that I'm like, God damn, that looks good. And I feel things about it, but I'm not sure that I'll think about the 400 blows like too deeply, like again. I don't know. Anyway, I liked it. Hmm. And so 16 key.
Wow. Yeah, man, I don't know. Like, just to say it again, the shots of the kids' faces watching the puppet show. Like I like it felt so, that felt so purposeful.
That was
not
a really
lose
wonderful
sight
scene.
Of any mm-hmm. sort of like joy of childhood within this. Like that felt so. Man, I don't know, y'all. I'm going 18.
Ooh, 18.
Which I almost backed off of because I was looking at our Crit Club spreadsheet of record, which you listeners can find in your show notes and follow along to all of the movies that we've watched and the ratings we've given them. Where I'm looking at, and I think I brought this up on our 50th episode. I'm looking 51st episode. Pardon me. That I only gave Vagabond an 18, which I really feel like should be at least a 19. Because I think I definitely liked Vagabond better than this movie, but it's not about the comparison.
I think that there's parts of Vagabond you're forgetting now.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know. I fucking loved Vagabond. I know. But I do like this is a rich movie for me. Like this is a very rich film. And I am honestly surprised by how much the 18 hours since I've watched it has already like grown in my mind. Even before I talked to you fine people and you all showed me things and ways of thinking about it that I didn't even consider. Like yeah, I'm surprised that this has held up in my estimation as high as it is. And I'm so fucking excited to have watched it. So yeah, 18 from me. And I guess that'll conclude our discussion of The 400 Blows. François Truffaut. Corey, you're going to be mad if
I... really only knew Truffaut as the scientist in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. That's really my only exposure.
Of course, so you're not going to be mad if I pick other French New Wave films.
No, I was happy to watch this. Seen. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's going to do it for our discussion about The 400 Blows. We would like to know what you thought. Which do we do first? Emails or next week? I forget which the thing is. Email shout out or next week?
Take a leap.
You know, I'm just going to do email. Like, what did you think of 400 Blows? I'm going to do that transition. What we thought about it. Well, now we want to know what you thought about The 400 Blows. You can do that by reaching us on email at critclubpodcast@gmail.com or find us on social media, Instagram or Threads with the handle critclubpodcast. Send us a link there. Tell us what you thought of 400 Blows. Tell us what you thought about other movies we've watched. Tell us what you would like us to watch. Tell us what you think about everything. We would love it. We'd love to hear from our wonderful, wonderful listeners. You can also tell us what you think about next week's show, which we will announce right now because, ladies and gentlemen, and non-binary people, we are having a wizard pick.
It's a wizard pick.
What are we watching next week?
Hi, I'm Wizard, and it's my pick. Hi, everybody. I'm very excited. Things have been a little serious around here lately, so we are going to shake it up. We are going to be watching 1981's Dreadnought, which is a Hong Kong martial arts comedy horror film directed by Yuen Woo-ping and starring Yuen Bao. It is about a fugitive criminal named White Tiger who is on the run from the law, and he attempts to blend in with a theater troupe, even though his face is painted in some real cool, like luchador style face paint, and I hope he keeps that look for the entire movie. But yeah, it's a comedy martial arts horror film from the 80s. I feel we could use something a little fun, a little excitement. High kicks. Lots of high kicks.
Listeners, it's only been three episodes since It's All About Love. Two episodes since and three episodes since Gothic.
Gothic. Oh, wow.
So please feel free to write into us and tell us what you think of Dreadnought. Watch along with us. I'm very excited about that wizard. That's going to be
good
rad.
Choice.
We'll have a good time.
Yeah. And that's not going to do it just yet for our podcast because we still have to catch up with each of us. We still have to catch up with what everyone is watching. And I'm going to do the same order I did before. I would love to know, Corey, what are you watching? What else are you watching?
Well, let's start off with Sexy Beast.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Oh.
For some reason, we all watched this 25-year-old movie this week.
Was it, do I take credit for that?
Yeah, I think you did.
Yeah. Okay.
I believe so. Yeah, I think it was our palate cleanser after recording
Hearts and Minds.
Who had seen this before?
Me.
Me.
Okay. I saw it in the theaters when it came out in 2000, last year of film school. One of my favorite films of that year.
Yeah, it just...
I watched it with a mutual friend, Corey, a mutual friend of ours, Steve. And I watched it a long time ago. Yeah,
this just missed me. And it's funny that it missed me because I was in the prime demographic for this.
This would have been a movie for me at like the time it came out. I can't believe I missed this one.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
I said my piece last week. You all talk. I don't know.
Okay. No, I guess my thing in the I was just pleasantly surprised by it. I said in our group chat that at the beginning of the movie, I was kind of like Milhouse being like, when are they going to get to the heist? But then like I realized that this is not a heist movie. I don't know. For some reason I had it in my mind this is going to be a heist movie. And obviously it's just not about that. It's about everything in between. And like, y'all are going to kill me. What's the name of the actor?
Roy.
Ben Kingsley. Yeah, obviously just slays the entire time.
Fucking incredible.
Yeah. I don't know if anyone else has anything to add.
What's crazy is when I watched it the first time in the theater, I was completely overwhelmed by Ben Kingsley's performance. Like, I was intimidated. It reminded me of Blood Simple in terms of how threatening and menacing the characters were. But watching it the second time, maybe it's because I've watched it more than once. I mean, since then, but I was not nearly as freaked out by Ben Kingsley this time as before. And I'm just curious, like, whether does that mean that I've been inured to this sort of thing, or did?
Oh, I still found him. Because when I rewatched it, because it's just such an unconventional villain, and I think like unexpected. Mm-hmm. Like to me, that was the heart of the terror I felt from that character is that I have no idea what the fuck this guy's going to do next.
Yeah. I don't know what this guy's about. I don't know what he's going to do. I think maybe we see more of these like unconventional, like gangster hitman type characters like now, especially in the 25 years since this movie came out. And so Angela, maybe what you're kind of experiencing is like more comfort with the kind of like, scary, possibly neurodivergent hitman character. I don't know. He's so great though. Like the source of his menace is something that I haven't seen from this kind of character before. It's like this like social like leveraging like social awkwardness while still being very scary.
So good.
It does continue the tradition of British films where like someone comes into your house and makes you really uncomfortable and you can't kick them out. Like I did think of The Shout.
Is this like
I did the think shout. Of The Shout, Peter.
God damn it.
It wasn't me. I didn't bring up The Shout this time.
I was trying to have a conversation a couple weeks ago with Noah about just kind of like how Pulp Fiction changed movies, because when you were living through it, it was like there was movies before Pulp Fiction, and then Pulp Fiction happened, and that changed the course of like, especially for like a good 10 years, there were a lot of movies that were trying to play catch up to like, you know, the sort of vibe that Pulp Fiction was.
Drive Away Dolls, everyone. If you want a little hit of that, go see Drive Away Dolls.
As a modern take on it.
Completely.
But this would have been a perfect example of this. Like this is a movie that feels very much like it wouldn't have existed without sort of that influence, I devoured those movies when I was younger. Yeah. So surprised I missed.
Oh yeah. Funny. Yeah. No, this was great. Sexy Beast was great. Was a great watch. Clips along. A lot of great character actors make an appearance. I love the relationship between these four friends who like are just content to like live in Spain together and enjoy retirement and eat shellfish. And just I really felt for them the whole time, like their lives being disrupted by this psychopath. Oh, yeah. So oh good. My goodness.
Well, what else did you watch, Corey?
Well, so Frida finished up her Jodie Foster marathon, watching all 49 of the 50 movies. We can't find
fucking
the
50th.
Ooh, very 49 of 50.
Movies. I probably watched a sixth of them, but I did end up seeing some movies that I hadn't seen before. But we did rewatch Contact, which I've probably seen a good half a dozen times in my life.
I've never seen that movie.
It's so fantastic. Good.
Oh,
it's
you should
fantastic.
See it, Peter.
Is it really? Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, it's super good, and it's I just remember every time I watch it, this is gonna sound a little silly, but like when that movie came out, I like felt seen, just as someone who was very like atheist and anti religion and all that stuff, and just like having a movie where the main character was also very much an atheist and also like battling against like sort of religious mores and all that stuff at the time. Like, I was like, wow, what a cool thing that I've never seen done in a movie before at the time that I saw it. So, but it's still, even beyond its themes, it's still just a great movie and like totally engaging and such a, you know, I think what it was trying to aim for is like, what would it actually look like if humans were contacted by aliens, and how would that actually play out in a non, you know, sensationalist way? And I think it does a great job, and it still totally holds up.
Is Matthew McConaughey in that movie?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That is my favorite Matthew McConaughey movie, then. Okay.
That's good. And then just the other one I wanted to mention is Forbidden Zone. So y'all should watch Forbidden Zone.
What is it?
Wizard, you should definitely watch it. I thought of you, Wizard, but I think everyone would find something enjoyable in it. So this was a movie. So back before Danny Elfman was a world-class composer and film scorer and all that stuff, back before Danny Elfman was in his band Oingo Boingo, he and his brother and a bunch of other people in LA in the 70s or something were in this theater troupe called the Mystical Knights of Oingo Boingo. And that's eventually what spun off into the band. It was this theater troupe who did this like strange, absurdist musical theater like review thing in LA that went on for a really long time. And so his brother, Richard Elfman, decided to like make this movie that was hopefully trying to give people like kind of a showing of what it would like be like to have watched this, you know, musical theater troupe that had been, you know, working together for many years. And it's extremely low budget, and it is charming as all hell, and it's way better than it needs to be. And it's super ridiculous and absurdist and all that, but it has, you can see so much of like the proto, especially because, I mean, Danny Elfman obviously is the spinoff, you know, success of this, you know, whole thing, but you can see so much of like the influence of his songs, the influence of like the kind of music that he does. There's all these like covers of like, I've had Pico and Sepúlveda stuck in my head for days now. And like this covers like Cab Calloway and all that stuff, but it's all in this like really just strange, weird movie. Also stars Harvey Vilacek for some reason. And like, I don't know. It's just like this, it was really, really charming. The whole thing is just extremely charming. There's a couple of things in there that's like, oh, we wouldn't do this in movies today anymore or whatever. But for the most part, I think it's a cult classic. That's also, again, that's like, teenage Corey would have absolutely loved this, and I'm really surprised that it had completely missed me. So,
cool.
Danny Elfman plays the devil, and he sings Minnie the Moocher, and it's pretty great. And yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm surprised that hasn't. I've never even heard of it. I don't think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Never. Not once. That sounds great.
Anyway, Angela, what else have you been watching?
Oh, it finally happened, everybody. I started watching Ted Lasso. Yeah, and it's, yeah, I needed that. It's the sweetness and the kindness and the friendliness that I've needed to see in the world. And I finally got a new laptop, and I was like, oh, 3 free months of Apple TV by all means. So I have been enjoying that. I mean, I started watching it yesterday, and I'm already like 8 episodes in. Then also saw the Dune 2, Dune and Dunener, last week. I liked the first one better, but I'll be sticking around for the third. And then I also did, I made it, guys. I saw Poor Things in the cinema for the 5th time. 5 times in the cinema.
5-timers club.
Yep.
God damn.
I liked it that much. And all with different people. I think I managed to get, in the end, like 8 people to go see that movie in the cinema.
Were you happy that you've been evangelizing this movie?
I am evangelizing this movie. In fact, during the Oscars, I didn't watch the Oscars because why? And I was like, no, I'm going to watch Poor Things instead. And I'm thrilled that it got as many awards as it did. It is my favorite movie of all time. But I am kind of glad that I'm done going to see it in the theaters.
Officially.
I'm officially done, at least for 20 years or something. I also picked up Alan Rickman's journals called Madly Deeply, The Diaries of Alan Rickman, the actor. And, I've always had a crush on him. So it's just like, it's not that, like, they're not too specific. Like, they're really weird.
They're not dishy?
They're not that dishy. They're like dishy. No. If you lived in England in the 1980s and 90s or were like in the theater scene, it was very dishy.
Coke was so good back then.
Yeah, exactly that.
But in Alan Rickman's voice.
Oh, yeah, I'll just listen to it in Alan Rickman's voice.
The Coke was so good back then.
And I can just pick it up and read like a page or two and say that I read a book today, which is great. But other than that, that's what I'm watching.
Excellent. Wizard, what else are you watching?
Oh, let's keep it short and sweet. I saw Dune 2. It's really wonderful, lovely, scrumptious visual experience. An excellent adaptation of a very difficult to adapt novel, especially the back half of the novel, which is, you know.
I can't believe I didn't get a chance to see it. Yeah.
It's dense. Yeah, maybe we'll talk about it again when we've all seen it. I'd be curious to see everybody's thoughts on Dune. But yeah, I'm still on board. I'll be around for the inevitable third quill, whatever.
For the inevitable jihad, space jihad.
Yeah. It's called a holy war in the movies for reasons. Anyway, it doesn't matter. What else am I watching? I got a twofer here, a little companion pieces. I am watching, I'm very much enjoying Shogun on FX.
Oh, that's on my list.
People are liking that, yeah.
Yeah, it's fun. You know, Shogun is such an excellent dad book, and the first miniseries is such an excellent dad miniseries that I got a lot of joy in watching this version of it. Which is cool in that, like, it is a miniseries about Japan where people like speak Japanese to each other and like they're subtitled and we care about them, which was a problem that the miniseries in the 70s kind of had. Anyways, it's super cool. It's very enjoyable. It's a short run. Everybody acts the hell out of it. There's cool samurai shit and intrigue, and it's like way more violent than you would expect. So, you know, your mileage may vary. Companion piece, though, I am watching back-to-back with Shogun. I am watching Tokyo Vice. Anybody taking a crack at Tokyo Vice?
Oh,
it's
shit.
It's Michael Mann's television series.
Yeah, I heard about it briefly last year, because it came out last year, right?
Yeah, so the second season has just started, or like I think they're into the second season, or maybe they just finished it. I forget exactly, but I just started watching it. It's about an American reporter who starts working at Tokyo's largest newspaper. He wants to work in the crime department. And it's just, you know, it's obviously like a Shogun companion piece because it is very much like white dudes floundering in Japan. But I think that the series, both Shogun and Tokyo Vice, kind of succeed in, like, again, like respecting the not spending too much time like celebrating like the outsider, like magical white person-ness of it all. They're both like just interesting series, some good drama, they've both been very enjoyable. So I would recommend both if you're kind of on the fence about that.
Amazing. I would recommend
Shogun, okay. And I would recommend Tokyo Vice. They're both dope. Peter, what else you watch?
Angela, I got to thank you for a tremendous, tremendous recommendation as you pushed me multiple times to go see Wim Wenders' newest film, Perfect Days. What a fucking good movie. Like, a fucking good movie. Like, just top to bottom, just a really clean, lovely, small, like, just beautiful as hell, and I would even say, like, hopeful and lovely character portrait of a man who cleans public toilets in Tokyo.
But it's not saccharine. There's nothing...
No.
It's not saccharine. It is...
No.
Oh, so good.
It's, like, it's really, like, you knocked it out of the park, Angela. Oh. Great. I'm, like, thank you so much for that recommendation. I fucking loved this movie. I really did, and I've thought about it so much, and it's just one of those, like... Wow, what a unique little story that that I haven't seen in a while, and I probably won't for a longer while. And just like it's also incredible to see like a director like Wim Wenders, you know, who's been doing this for decades and decades and decades. The man behind Wings of Desire, the man behind Peter Falk playing an angel, playing himself, coming up with this. And it was just such a good movie. I really recommend it to anybody. It was also a fantastic date movie. Turned out, yeah. Just like a really awesome time. That's my biggest recommendation.
I love that movie because it tells the story with the things that it doesn't say. Mm-hmm. Right? It's all in the nuance, and but it's so rich. If you're paying attention, it's all there. It's
And I love character studies like that are so much about process, where it's like watching this guy live his life, but like you're watching the steps that he takes to, you know, put his life together. So fucking good. I've also been going a little bit down, I guess, a 90s hole here, where I guess I'm on season 6 of X-Files.
Wonderful.
Rewatching X-Files.
Why not?
Because I think I've I watched it. So I feel like it's crazy how much I watched when I was at that age and when it was coming out in the 90s. And then I guess died out, slowed down definitely, especially by the time the movie came out, which was after the 5th season. And then I don't think I've ever seen the last couple seasons of it. And so I'm trying to power through and see the overarching conspiracy stuff is actually a lot more interesting than I remember it being. So, it's still a silly ass show, still goofy as hell, still silly as fuck. But kind of a real fun rewatch and kind of a good nostalgia sort of time. I've also been watching several 90s movies that I would not recommend. One, did I mention Darkman or just you all?
I think you did.
Okay. Yeah. Fucking Darkman's incredible. I also rewatched The Crow. Oh, I would not recommend rewatching The Crow.
No.
That movie did not hold up to me in the slightest.
But the soundtrack does.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. And it was definitely one of those where I still have so much room to grow as a person, as a white man. Because at the end of it, I was like, why is the whole movie about this man's pain when it's about the woman's death? The woman is just served as the subject for his pain. And it's just one of those that the fridging, is that what it's called?
Fridging, or something? Why does he come back, but she doesn't? Questions
exactly.
This, you know?
Yes, precisely. Where it's fuck this movie. This movie sucks. But also even beyond that, it sucks. That movie sucks. That's all.
I don't know if
that's all. Anybody else?
I don't know if I could ever face existence as thinking The Crow is anything other than pretty good movie. That movie occupies a place in my 15, 14 year old consciousness that if I found out it was a bad movie, guys, I might stop wearing eyeliner when I go to the club.
I'm sure the remake will be even better.
No, I'll admit something to you, Wizard. I guess that, and why not to our listeners as well, that I fucking watched The Crow last month, maybe at the end of January, and I straight up rewatched it again this past week.
Huh. What's happening?
Because I had such a bad time with it. I'm listening to another series of podcasts and they're doing some rewatches of old stuff and I following along with them. And they were getting excited about that. And I'm I really disliked it in January. It can't be that bad. I'm going to try it because I also have it. It looms large in my 13-year-old, 14-year-old brain whenever it came out. But no, rewatching it twice in the past 2 months, I deeply dislike that movie.
Damn.
That's all. I'm done. And this podcast is done.
We're done.
Yeah.
And
for this week, anyway.
For this week, yeah, definitely. Thank you all so much for talking about 400 Blows. And listeners, thanks for following along and hearing us chat about all of the stuff. We cannot wait to also watch along with you next week when we will be looking at what, Wizard?
We're watching Dreadnought. There will be more than 400 blows. There will be a flurry of blows.
Count the blows, listeners,
let
us know how many they
another
are.
Another one for the D&D crowd.
That's right.
We're processing your feedback, listeners. We really are.
We are. Yes. We're trying. Mm-hmm. We're trying.
You can send us your blow counts at critclubpodcast@gmail.com or on social media at critclubpodcast. Yeah, don't isolate that either. Thank you, Wizard. Thank you, Angela. Thank you, Corey. Thank you, listeners. Great episode. Great time with you all. I will see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye. Au revoir.
Bye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
À tout à l'heure.